Hello and welcome to today's Radio Hour from Tao Center for the Arts. I'm Chelsea. We're here every other Monday at 9 a.m. sharing reflections and conversations around art and the humanities. This morning, the artist Maria Corol shares her beliefs, artistic passion, and her work with Colette Leboeuf. After that, we have art news with Alice Moyon, and then we hear from Saoirse Morgan, creator of the Hum magazine. First, we'll drop into Colette Leboeuf's conversation with Maria Corol. Corol was born in Argentina, and her early story is intertwined with the politics of South America in the 1980s. She was born during a time when the Argentinian dictatorship, which was supported by the United States, ruled a regime of terror where thousands of people disappeared. Corol's parents, themselves young and with a family, emigrated to Brazil for a few years before returning to Argentina. The complex history of Argentina, Brazil, and the political events of the region all inform Corol's work. Her art delves into the memories and long-lasting impact of these events. Here's Maria Corol talking with Colette Leboeuf.
Thank you for having me. I'm too excited to talk with you and reconnect with people across states. Yeah, so my biography is very much a part of my work because just to give you some generals, I was born in 1980 in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. And it was the middle of a really harsh dictatorship that we went through for 7 years in the country. And my parents, because they were very young, they were 18 when they had me, were frightened. They are Jewish, they're hippies, they're 18, and there is this government that is disappearing people. So they decided to go to Brazil, and there was also a dictatorship in Brazil. There were dictatorships all over Latin America at the time, in Chile and Argentina and Brazil. Anyway, they kind of, because they were not from Brazil, they kind of hid there. And so I was basically in exile until I was 5 years old, and I learned how to speak in Portuguese and Spanish. And when I had to start elementary school, we went back to Buenos Aires. So right away in my childhood, there was sort of this dissonance or political turmoil that affected my family, and it obviously really marked me. So history really informs my work. I don't know, I'm very interested in the connections. It's kind of like a feminist theory that has been explored a lot, but it's the individual's experiences and the personal as part of the political and how those two things get kind of wrapped together. Mm-hmm. And the experiences of one person are unique, but also not so, you know, like a lot of connections between other people that lived similar experiences.
In terms of a collective experience as well.
Yeah, like you have your unique personal experience, and then you realize all of these geopolitical aspects that influenced your experience and how they are shared with so many people. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting to me. Also, I studied dance for a really long time. When I was 13, I started, which is late.
What kind of dance?
Classical and modern as well. But yeah, it's like for classical dance, being 13 is like starting really late. And so, but I did that for 10 years until I was 23. And that also really influences my visual arts work now because I had all that training. Mm-hmm. And at some point I kind of realized that that wasn't, like, it's very athletic and there is, you have to put so much into like your physical training. And I wanted to read and I always like drawing and I was like, oh, this is just too much. And I want to also like do my own ideas and interpretations of what's around me. And in dance, you are an interpreter more than a creator, unless you're a choreographer. Mm-hmm. So I kind of switched, but I feel like all the physical training still really influences what I do because my drawings, I work mostly in drawing, but I also do sculpture and I do animations now. Mm-hmm. Where you have actual movement on a drawing. Mm-hmm. But it's digital, obviously. The figure, it starts with a figure most of the times. Like all of my drawings, even these ones that you see behind me that are very abstract.
Those are all drawings.
Yeah, these are drawings. I mean, people sometimes call them paintings, and I understand why, because they are large, and you know, I use oil pastels and I mix acrylic paint and oil paint, so you have painting there. Anyway, they all, even when you see something purely abstract like this one,
right,
it's layers on top of figures. So you always have people and a narrative as the first layer in the works. And oftentimes those narratives are either from my memories or from books that I'm reading. I read a lot. I'm married to a writer and partly fell in love with him because of books, because he reads. Anyway, for example, in 2019, I was reading Roberto Bolaño, who is my favorite Chilean writer. I mean, he's my favorite writer, but he happens to be Chilean. And I was making a lot of drawings based on characters in his book, 2666, and then characters from his book, The Savage Detectives. And he does something that is very inspiring to me, which is that he, even though he's Chilean and he was exiled when he was 14 because of the dictatorship to Mexico, and then he ended up in Spain, he still has this really international view, and he doesn't write what you would expect, you know? Like, he doesn't abide by formulas, and he will have like a Uruguayan woman be the protagonist of one of his books, Amuleto. Amuleto is the title of the book, or Amulet.
On your website, you show some bodies of work. And so one of them is 2666, yeah?
2666.
2666. Okay, is that it?
666, yes.
Okay, okay.
So that body of work, 2666, is the one based on Roberto Bolaño's novel.
Okay.
And yeah, and that novel follows mostly real events, situation that happened in Mexico, in Ciudad Juárez, between 1993 and 1997, where there was a rampage of murders of young women, working class. All that historical fictionalizing is very fascinating to me. And I was just studying the book, and I was being influenced by his ideas. But I never do it in a one-to-one or illustrative aspect. Yeah, for example, one of the drawings is called The Femicides of Santa Teresita.
That's my favorite. I wanted to know, you know, who are these women also?
Yeah, so in that one, I did not do an animation of the creation of it, but I can explain it to you the way that it happened. And it is that I made a drawing of a factory, and I made a drawing of women walking out of the factory. And then, because this book is talking about all these murders of these young women, I drew some dead women around the composition. So I was kind of like illustrating and adding figurative elements, but you know, this happened, but still, that's not the only thing that defines the place. There is movement and change and transformation, even though you have bodies on the ground and murder as part of that complex history. But I tried to develop it until I start to go into a more abstract mode. And for me, there's still this intention and intensity of the story in the image that kind of throbs, or like, you know, is there under the layers. But then you also have this inviting, beautiful place and structure that you do want to engage with.
I wanted to ask also about night work. Can you talk about that a little bit, that body of work?
Do you know Christine Scott? She has a book of short stories called Night Work, and I kind of borrowed that name for my show. And the stories in her book are about women and about situations that are complicated that these women are going through. And in my show, I was thinking about a particular historical moment in Argentina that was when in the 1920s, it started kind of like at the turn of the century and it went all the way to the 1920s. And it was a Jewish mafia called Sui Migdal that was bringing women from really impoverished Eastern European towns to Buenos Aires. And they had like a huge ring of prostitution. Some of the women were forced into sex labor and other women were prostitutes already in their small towns. And they decided to, well, if I'm going to do it here, maybe I better do it in Buenos Aires, which at the time was a very rich cosmopolitan city. Argentina was like top 10 richest countries in the world at that time. So some of them were like, yeah, I'd rather go there. And others were tricked into thinking that they had a husband waiting for them and then they would arrive. And it was like, never mind, now you have to be a sex worker. So I was thinking about all the history and, you know, just really interested in these ideas about intersectional feminism and what does it mean to be a sex worker and why is it such a stereotype of like the bad woman, you know, they they left a difficult situation and arrived in a new city and made a life in a new city. So I started making works about that. And you see a lot of figures and a lot of abstraction as well. So yeah. In the same mode where I have some of the narratives be a little bit more illustrative. So it's the street and the house where they worked. And, you know,
and I really have the sense of reading them. Of reading the works, you know, and you keep using the word narrative, which that's how they strike me, you know, that there's action in them. There are things happening. There's movement, even in piece to piece, a kind of movement between them. So that's so interesting that it's, that there's this, what you were thinking or what, you know, what you were trying to understand is also a story itself. A history.
History and story, the work is imaginative and artistic. So it includes sort of this very personal interpretation of historical events. So I think it's also a way to give power to certain voices that were not powerful in the past, that we don't necessarily have a good record to understand their experiences. So it's almost like you embody that experience and you create something that might not be like a record, you know?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
But it's adding to the conversation about what it might have been like to be in that position.
Yeah.
That was Maria Carol, artist and visiting professor at Morehouse College, a historically Black college and university in Atlanta, Georgia. She's speaking with Colette LaBeouf. When we come back, more from the artist and her collaborations with others. Before that, we're taking a musical break with Chris Sunshine and his recently released album, Rainbow Vision. Here's Tiny Home.
Dreamer, sleeper, I feel you won't be sighing me. Radiated. Your tears still wet, leave in pain. I don't believe that you saw me. I'm tiptoeing now to cross the breeze. Our homes fragile. I kick the pillars and beams. Made it rattle and hurt us with the debris. took a walk. Needed to breathe. The street lights on. Helping me see.
Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. Today, one of our guests is Maria Corol, a visual artist whose work is shown nationally and internationally. She continues her conversation with Colette Leboeuf about how collaborations sometimes begin and flourish. In this case, we hear about Corol's work with Elena Rykova. Rykova, a Russian composer and visual artist, and Corol met in Germany during an artist residency in 2016. Their encounter led to an exploration of visual art, physical space, and music.
There's on your website a section about collaborations. I think you list it as interdisciplinary work. And I'm curious about how that works with your drawings and working with other artists, what you're doing.
Yeah, I have my main girl with whom I work with, Elena Rykova. Shout out to Elena. She's my main buddy. And she is a person that I met in an artist residency in Berlin in 2016. And we were both there for 3 months and we overlapped at the same time in the studios at the Tiergarten in the Academy der Künste. And she is an experimental composer. And right away, I was very drawn to her because she showed her scores for musical compositions and their drawings. And they're just really gorgeous drawings that she makes explaining how, for example, a pianist is to play the piano for this experimental piece in which what they're playing is not the keys of the piano, but the inside of the piano. Wow. So she has these ideas that I'm like, what? I love what she's doing. She has another piece for a ping pong table played with pine cones. Wow. So, you know, it's very performance oriented, and the way that she thinks about it, it starts visually with drawings. So she was presenting about her work and I was like, girl fanning on whatever she was showing. Fangirling or girlfriend, I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
I get it. Yeah. Get it.
And then we started talking and turns out we overlap during our residencies for 3 months. And I was like, well, we better do something together because I really like your work and she liked mine too. So we did our first collaboration, which was freestanding drawings made with like thicker cardboard that were instruments as well. So it's drawings and it's an installation, but the drawings are stiff and they stand and you can play them because we used fishing line and metal rods. So we could like improvise sounds with these drawings. Yeah, pretty cool. And we recorded all of that. And then she did a composition, like a musical composition with the sounds, and I did an animation. And then we presented all of that as a culmination for the residency. So that was our first. And then she went to Boston to study. And so she was coming to the US. I don't know if I mentioned that she's from Russia. She's from a place called Ufa in Russia. And I think there was also a little bit of a strange genealogical connection between us because my family, years past, was like my ancestors, I guess, were from the Ukraine.
Okay.
Which was Russia when they left because of the pogroms. Mm-hmm. They ended up in Argentina. And she had seen my last name, which is Korol with a K, which means king in Russian. And she had thought that I was Russian too. Mm-hmm. And I arrive and I'm like Argentinian. And she's like, what? And I was like, I love my Russian friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we had that going on. So we're kind of like fake sisters. Anyway, we wanted to keep working together because it was so fun to do that first project. And we stayed in touch and worked together in 2018 on more in like instruments that I made out of clay. So they were sculptures, but they made sounds as well. And she came to visit me and we jammed with these instruments and recorded sounds. And then she made another musical composition. And then we did this last one in 2020, which was very challenging, but probably our best one. A Cow in the Backyard is the title.
I love that title.
Yeah, the title is really funny. And we were inspired by one of the musical technicians in Berlin. So this piece was to be presented in Berlin as well with an ensemble called Ensemble Mosaic that plays the instruments. And then the project has an animation as well, 3-screen animation. Anyway, she and I were communicating with the ensemble and with a musical technician and the video technician, preparing everything remotely for the presentation the way you do in 2020. And she was explaining very poetically how she wanted the acoustics to sound on the stage. And then Arne, who was the sound technician, responded and he was like, I totally understand it. It's like entering a restaurant and there is a lot of people and they're all well-dressed and you keep walking towards your table and then you go to the bathroom and then you walk to the back of the restaurant and you see the dead cow. And we were like, yes.
I love it.
That's exactly the way it should sound. Yeah, so then we didn't want a dead cow necessarily, but we like the idea of a cow in the backyard.
That project, because it was 2020, was it able to have a live audience?
Yeah. In Germany, they're a little bit better organized and doing things a little bit better than in the United States. And so they had all the protocols in place and it was premiered on September 3rd to an audience of less than 50 people. Mm-hmm. And they're all sitting 2 meters away from one another. We had to modify a few things. For example, we wanted the musicians to be not just on the stage, but mingle with the audience. And it was great.
That's so cool.
And then what was also really good is that because I had the show at the gallery after that here in Atlanta, what we did is we reformat the project. So instead of the gigantic 3 screens and the musicians live, which is what we had in Berlin, we presented it in a really intimate space in Atlanta with smaller screens and headphones. It's good, yeah, because also presenting things far away, I mean, yes, you get the photos and the recording of the event and that's exciting, but at the same time, I was like, we were supposed to travel there and do it together and be there with the musicians and see it live, but we couldn't. Yeah. So that was a little bit of a bummer, but then I got to at least include it on the side of my show here in Atlanta and see
right.
It.
Right. You're also a professor. Tell me about where you're teaching right now and what you teach. And
yes. So the first thing I want to say is that I'm teaching at Morehouse College and Reverend Warnock is an alum. So we are celebrating really hard that he is going to the U.S. Senate. It's amazing. And yeah, I'm teaching at Morehouse College. I teach art courses. I teach mostly drawing classes and design. And I have one class on African-American muralism. And it's really great because before teaching at Morehouse College, I had been teaching at Agnes College here in Atlanta, in Decatur. And I had a class that I proposed on Mexican muralism. And I didn't know if there would be interest in it or not. It was in the context of leadership. And I was like, well, Mexican muralism would be very cool because obviously they were very political in their murals, and they created a golden age of muralism that spread from Mexico in the 30s and 40s to the United States. And so they said yes to that class, and I taught it for 3 years. And then in the transition to Morehouse, to this African-American muralism class, it was really great to have that connection because obviously there is influences. Artists like Charles White that was actually like looking at Diego Rivera and thinking about what Diego Rivera was doing. And even stylistically, you see it in the images that he made. So yeah, I'm really excited. And I love the students that I have here. As a Latina, to be teaching in a historically Black college and having that exchange of cultural information with the students, it's just fantastic.
Yeah.
That's another big part of why I love this city. I'm just like, yes.
Yeah. How does it work for you as an artist, as a visual artist, to teach also? How does your what you make and what you teach work together? Or not?
Yeah, that's really interesting always because, you know, with my students, I have to keep telling them because it's beginners classes that I'm teaching. I keep saying, follow the rules, you know, do the projects as I say. There are parameters and, you know, there are like standards for something that is right and something that is not so right. But then that's not really true in the studio. So there is like a little bit of a double standard that once you really actually want to make your art, you have to squash all the rules and say, I'm going to make it up the way that I need to. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm following the rules, I'm doing exercises and it's not really that expressive. Mm-hmm. It might be more correct and more safe in terms of aesthetics, but it's not. It lacks kind of like a certain force or artistic complexity. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's like a little bit of both. I keep having a lot of conversations with them about what's the value in doing an exercise and proving that you can, you know, just try it and say, you know, I can do that. And then you maybe don't use it ever again if it's not serving your purposes. Mm-hmm. But I do like technique. Even if when I'm trying to make my own work, I have to negotiate the level of technique that will preoccupy me. Because if I'm just worried about the technique, then it becomes too stiff, you know. Yeah, and I had a good conversation with a student this past semester who was very inquisitive. And he was like, well, but, you know, what about in basketball? Like, there is something like raw talent. There are people that just have raw talent. And what are you going to do with someone like that? And I'm like, yeah, there are people that have raw talent and they can go to the court and play a great game, but they're not going to be in the NBA because to be in the NBA, you need to know the rules of the game. Like these guys know the rules and they do a certain amount of training weekly and they eat certain foods. You know, like there is a certain regimen that happens. Mm-hmm. Make that raw talent get pro. And I'm like, you know, you want to be a pro, then you're going to have to study those things. Mm-hmm. If you just have raw talent and don't want to study anything, you might get really lucky and be like Basquiat and like make it because, you know, like you just are in the right place and you know the right people and they see your talent and you just make it to the top. Mm-hmm. But it's much harder. Like if you don't have the context of the discipline and you don't know how it's played.
Yeah, absolutely. Maria, what are you working on right now? What's next or coming up for you?
So I am going to have another collaboration with Elena, and now we included a dancer in the team. Her name is Anna, and we're gonna try to see if we can do something where we had visual arts and sound and movement incorporated.
Wonderful.
Musicians and video and clay objects again as instruments. Mm-hmm. And then I'm working on a writing piece that maybe I should send to you and you can look at it and tell me. It's a piece for an arts magazine here in the South called Art Papers.
Okay.
Very good arts magazine based here in Atlanta. So I was invited to do a collaboration because the theme of the next magazine will be transformation and camouflage. And, you know, my work has these figures under the abstraction and
right. Fits
the thematics of this one. And I decided to write something about the constitutional reform that they're going to do in Chile.
Okay.
Super exciting. They voted in November 25th of this past year, and they're going to get rid of the constitution that they have, which is the one that was passed under Pinochet in a referendum that was probably fraudulent in 1980, the year I was born. And they just passed that, which is so exciting. And so I'm kind of writing this geopolitical poetry
mm-hmm.
sort of thing
mm-hmm.
where I'm mixing my own history with the history of Chile. The editor of this magazine and I were talking about this project, and her name is Sarah, and she was saying that a piece for a magazine that is published gives artists this sort of different context to explore their own work. So it's like a new manner of accessing your ideas. And
absolutely.
I love it. It's really
absolutely
good.
That was Maria Corol. The Argentinian artist is currently living in Atlanta, Georgia, where she is a visiting assistant professor at Morehouse College. You can learn more about her work at Maria Corol, that's MariaKorol.com. We've got more for you coming up, but first, here's Young Skater, a tune by Chris Sunshine. And when we come back, we'll visit a conversation I had with Sorsha Morgan last year, and we'll share some news from the art world. Stay with us. Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. A couple months ago, I talked with Sorsha Morgan about her current project, The Hum Magazine. The Hum Magazine is about Taos and the people in our community, who they are and what they do. The Hum Magazine is a colorful rendition of interviews and pictures through which Morgan explores our community. Here's part of a conversation we had last year.
We met years ago on the set of a play, The Clean House by Sarah Rule. So I know you as a performer. on stage. And I'm just kind of wondering if that's still part of your work and your practice or your life.
Theater in Taos kind of found me. I wasn't like looking for it. But I grew up in theater. My mom grew up in theater, and it's something that I've always done. I'm still in touch with a lot of the theater community out here, and every once in a while I get invitations to participate in projects.
So I think there was a period of time that you were kind of back and forth between Taos and elsewhere. And then I think just in the last handful of years, you've really settled down, like you're here.
Well, it's a strange story. It's like one of those weird stories that's just like weird to tell over, but it's like kind of cliche too. I was living in the big city, San Francisco, at the end of 2014, and going into 2015, my life just changed very drastically, and I, on a whim, bought an RV and said, I'm living the nomadic life. And Taos was one of the first places that I visited on my pilgrimage. And when I first came here, I just remember having like this sense of like home, this sense of like, you know, belonging, and like the sense of just being who you are without judgment. I spent a year and a half on the road, and then I decided to come back to Taos and live here full time. And then, I believe it was 2017, tragically, I had to go to a funeral in Los Angeles, and I had every intention of coming back, but I ended up getting stuck in Los Angeles for 3 years. Taos was still very much a part of me. Like, all my life was still out here. All my belongings were still out here, but I was just living from afar. And it's funny because like right before I left, I think this was like a few months, I had gotten a tarot reading in Arroyo Seco, and she said, oh, Taos is sending you away for some time, but you'll be back. And I was just like, there's no way I'm leaving Taos. I love Taos. But I was sent away. And then last year, I decided to come back full time. And so I've been back in Taos for now like over a year. I just love it here, and it's a place that I see myself being for like the rest of my life.
Let's talk about the Hum magazine. What is it and how does it work? And I think it's designed, I think you use the phrase, designed as a community participation magazine. And tell me what that is.
So yeah, the Hum, I actually have a copy right here, the Hum magazine. It's really spectacular, because if you had even asked me 2 months ago, was this something that I ever saw myself doing, I would say no. The Hum magazine is designed to be a participation magazine. It's for those people who have a story to tell. Like myself, I'm not from Taos. And there's much appreciation when you're from here. And I think like there's a lot of people who don't genuinely get to tell their story. And it's much like the Taosum, you know. I tell people it's like you hear about it and you know about it, but you don't always, you know, you don't always know where it comes from or what's the origin or what it exactly sounds like. And so, you know, these were just, you know, my first issue was from people that I knew in town. Like they were my Hum. Like these were people that I knew over the last, you know, over 5-6 years being in Taos. And the first Hum was my Hum. And now what's great about the Hum is now the Hum is coming to me. It's like, yeah, I know that person, but like, I don't know that person. Mm-hmm. So that's like the Hum.
I think so far you've published, at least what I can see online, you've published over a dozen pieces, and some pieces are profiles and then other pieces are writing submitted from community members. And I'm curious, what have you learned in the process of getting this project together? Assuming you haven't done something like this before.
I haven't done something like this before. And I think that I might get emotional. It's a disclaimer. And I try to hold it back because I often like think about, you know, what I'm doing, what am I getting out of it? And I think like it brings me great joy to see like the excitement, because it's not just people telling their story. They come into my studio. We put them in professional hair and makeup. We give them this outerly Hollywood experience, and it's this whole thing that they go through. You know, I've had people cry, people tell me that this was the most, you know, amazing experience that they've ever had. And I think for me, being able to serve people, I think there's no greater gift than being able to say, I see you, let me serve you, let me let me give you something. It's you know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the photography that goes along with these profiles and these submissions. So far, what I've seen, these very bright, strong primary colors in the back. And then you're right. I mean, people are, there's a preparation that's going into this photography. It's really cool. Like, I know some of the people that have been profiled, so it's neat to see them photographed in this way. To me, some of the photographs, they're really intimate, I think, and personal. And what's that process like for you in doing the photography? I mean, it's one thing to sit like we are and talk to each other, exchange words, we're on Zoom. But I think it's a whole nother thing to take pictures of people.
Yeah. Because first of all, it's really like awkward getting so uncomfortable about letting somebody do their makeup, you know, getting past that first initial stage when people want to do this, but they're shy. They've never even worn makeup or they've never even had their picture taken. So it is a whole process, you know, until they get into the studio and then they're in the chair. You know, when they come in the studio, I say, what's your playlist? What music do you like? I start with the music, put the music on. And it's this whole massaging thing, getting them used to it. So by the time they step in front of the camera, you know, they're a little shy and they're a little stiff. But I have this way when I have the camera, you know, I'm very animated as well. And I'm like, girlfriend, yes. I like hype them up that by the end, they're like superstars. And you can see that in the pictures, they are very intimate. And that is the trust that me and this person have built. And, you know, I've led them all the way through, let them know every step of the process, you know, let them do what they feel comfortable with. And I think it's like a dance. Everything was step by step and it came together to make something really intimate and really beautiful and really connected, because you know you have to have that trust. And like there's more pictures we took. I'm sad I couldn't publish all the photos of all these great people, but we took some great photos.
Stories and people, I mean, it's obvious, but kind of what was the bug in your mind about that? And I say that because you could do a magazine about anything. You know, you could do a magazine about photography or people that take pictures, but you have an emphasis on people and their stories. And
yeah, I guess the answer to that is I have to start with my own story. And this is where I get emotional, because this is what I often think about when I think about the Hum magazine. On a global level, on a national level, and even on a micro level and an individual level, we've all experienced adversity. And we're all experiencing adversity in multiple ways on multiple levels. And this year, just like many, has been a very, very difficult year. I just lost a lot of my identity in a very dark place. And I had no idea it was coming. I had no idea that there was these depths within me. And I'm a very observant person. I studied psychology in college and communications, and I've spent a lot of my life walking around this earth, people watching. You know, I was homeschooled. And so by the time I was old enough to go and travel on my own, I'd spent a lot of my time alone, just like observing life and people and imagining like what their life was like. And when I was going through these dark times, I was trying to remember myself and remember who I was as a person. And I think trying to find myself, I also looked out around me at other people for inspiration and truth. And the truth is, no matter what you're going through, you have to keep going. And so when I looked up and saw the people around me that were keep going, you know, the people who were in this magazine, Julia Fernandez with the Body Shop LLC, you know, all her stuff is shut down, you know, and she's still going, you know, she's struggling, she's still going, you know, Ryan Timmerman's, the Veterans Off Grids, you know, still out there every week with a handful of volunteers. Like, that's hope. And that reminded me that there are so many stories to tell, so many great, great stories.
That was Sorsha Morgan sharing her work on the Hum magazine. Learn more about it at thehummagazine.com. And now let's catch up on some news in the art world with Alice Morion.
Мне было красивый ретик. Был в этом небе паспорт ретик. На моей не ты разжигали тик. Я люблю красивый наш, не оставляющий улик. Электричеством по нервам, я сегодня вам не верю.
This was Rage, the latest song released by Pussy Riot. Pussy Riot is a Russian punk rock, feminist, and political activist group founded in 2011. The band became internationally known in 2011 upon criticizing the Russian Orthodox Church and its link to Russian government. Although they underwent jail time and repression from the regime, the group has been active since then. They have held many performances and have extended their political battle beyond Russia. Let's listen to their first song written in English. It's called I Can't Breathe. It was released in 2015 to protest against illegitimate violence from authority figures after the death of Eric Garner, who said these last words under the chokehold of an NYPD officer in 2014. This February, Pussy Riot released Rage, a song recorded last year in Moscow. The song, with lyrics in Russian, came out amid a surge of protest over the jailing of Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader to Putin's regime. Navalny has been a political opponent to Putin for several years. He was convicted in 2013 and 14 for embezzlement. These convictions are considered to be politically motivated. Last August, he was poisoned and expatriated to Germany to recover. Upon coming back to Russia in January, he was detained and sentenced for 2.5 years in a penal colony. That led to mass protests all over Russia. According to OVD Info, more than 11,000 people have been arrested for protesting so far. Pussy Riot's song, Rage, comes as yet another stance to fight this oppression. Let's listen to the end of the song, which was released on February 1st to support the fight for political freedom in Russia. At the end of January, New Mexico was recognized by the magazine Movie Maker as a great location for the film industry, with Albuquerque and Santa Fe being outlined for the high quality of life and work for movie makers. This doesn't quite come as a surprise, as New Mexico's film industry has been booming for many years now, with its strong incentive policy that allows up to 30% of tax credit. The impact of the movie industry in New Mexico is big. Over $270 million have been spent in New Mexico in the last fiscal year, and this figure is expected to grow. Big production companies are well aware, and Netflix and NBC Universal have been investing in studios in Albuquerque. In 2018, Netflix acquired Abiquiu Studios and has since spent over $200 million in the States. Last November, they announced that they were going to expand their production in New Mexico, by committing an additional $1 billion for production spend. Recent Netflix hits produced in New Mexico include Godless and coming up, the fourth season of Stranger Things. That was Alice Morillon with your art news. I wish you a great day, and I will leave you with a quick excerpt of Identifying Features, a strong and beautiful movie that portrays a mother looking for her son at the American border.
Yo ando buscando a mi hijo. La última vez que lo vi fue hace 2 meses. Mi hijo desapareció cuando tomó un camión que iba para la frontera.
Indícame si reconoce algo.
Yo sé el empaque. Le digo que a mi hijo lo asaltaron.
No ande preguntando esas cosas en público. No sabe quién la puede escuchar.
You have been found guilty of improper entry into the United States of America. You're now in removal procedures.
This brings us to the end of the hour. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been Tau Center for the Arts Radio Hour, brought to you with generous support from this station, KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming live at truetausradio.com, and our local business partner, Taos Opera Guild. The music we heard this hour was written and performed by Chris Sunshine from his latest album, Rainbow Vision. Here's the song, Amphibian. Be well, everybody. We'll be back here the week after next. Have a great day.